Gemara says in Rosh Hashanah, Sechter Rosh Hashanah, Tanya Rabbi Eliezer Aymer, Eliezer says, Tishrei Nivra Ha'olam, the month of Tishrei the world was created, Tishrei Neildu Aves, and in the month of Tishrei the patriarchs were born, Tishrei Mesu Aves, they died in the month of Tishrei. So the Pesach Meilad Yitzchak was born in Pesach, but he says Bereish Hashanah and Rosh Hashanah Nifkeda Sarah Rochel V'Chana. In Rosh Hashanah, three heroines of Jewish history who were barren conceived: Sarah, the matriarch Sarah; Rochel, the matriarch Rochel, also conceived on Rosh Hashanah; and Chana, the mother of the prophet Shmuel. B'Rosh Hashanah Yatza Yosef mi Beis HaAsurim. In Rosh Hashanah, Yosef HaTzadik was summoned by the Pharaoh to interpret his dream, and he became the viceroy on that day and was made ruler over the land of Egypt. Elsewhere in Masechet Rosh Hashanah, the Gemara says, "Imru lefonai v'Rosh Hashanah." You should recite before me on Rosh Hashanah Malchiyos Zichreinos v'Sheifreis, the themes of sovereignty, of remembering, and the Sheifer. Malchiyos Kedesh Tamlichuni Aleichem, the theme of sovereignty, in order that you may accept my kingship over you. Zichreinos, the theme of memory. Kedesh Yale Zichreinechem Lefonei Latev, in order that the memory of you will come before me to find favor in my eyes. Ubameh, and all of this, how is this to happen? How are you to declare my kingship, and how are you to invoke my memory? With the Shefer. Amar Rabbi Abu. So Rabbi Abu says, Lama taking b'shefer shalayo. Why do we use the horn of a ram as opposed to some of the other animals? Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Hashem Yisbarach says, Tiku lefonai b'shefer shalayo. Sound before me the sounds that come from a horn of a ram. Kedei she'ezker lechem akedas Yitzchak ben Avraham, in order that I may remember or be reminded of the akedah, the binding of Yitzchak, the son of Avraham. U'mal ani alechem kilo akadetem atzmechem lefonai. And then I will consider it as though you had bound yourselves up before me. So the sounding of the Shefer on Rosh Hashanah, while it announces God's kingship and takes the theme of memory, all of this falls into, or is created by, is invoked by, the memory of the Akedah. The Akedah is the event which gives the Shefer its significance. In Medrash Rabin Vayikra, the Medrash tells the following story. Avram le'somach be'ilami. Medrash says that God asserted that Avram did not rejoice in my world. It goes on to say that he had a child, he had a son at the age of 100, and at the end, Having raised this child, Hashem said to him, God said to Avram, please take your son and offer him as a sacrifice. And Avram traveled for 3 days. After 3 days, he saw a cloud of glory covering the mountain. And he turned to his son and he asked him, what do you see? And he says, I see the cloud of glory over the mountain. He then turned to Yishmael and Eliezer and asked them if they saw anything. They said, they see nothing. So he instructed them to remain where they were camped, and he and Yitzchak went through the Akedah. And were it not for the fact that the angel prevented him, then Yitzchak would have in fact been slaughtered. Medrash goes on to say that when Yitzchak returned to his mother, she said to him, where were you, my son? There's a different gilsa. I'll read you a different gilsa in a minute. According to this medrash, Yitzchak returned to his mother, and she said to him, where were you, my son? So Yitzchak responded, my father took me, and we went over hill and dale, and he put me on an altar and was about to shecht me when an angel stopped him. So she exclaimed, woe unto my son, the son of one who is intoxicated. Were it not for the fact that the angel stopped your father, you would have been slaughtered. So Yitzchak said yes. So at that, she screamed six screams, from which we derive the six tekiyos, the Medrash says. And at the conclusion of those six screams, she died. That's the Medrash Rabbah. Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer gives it a little bit of a different twist. When the Satan, when Satan saw that he was unable to prevent this majestic spiritual act of self-sacrifice, So this Satan came to Sarah, and he said to Sarah, hey, Sarah, did you hear what happened? What's going on in the world? So she said, no. So he said, your old husband, implying that he was senile, had lost his mind, took Yitzchak and offered him as a sacrifice. And the lad was crying and screaming, and he couldn't save himself. So thereupon, she began to weep and to scream. She cried three cries corresponding to the three tekiyos and three yalolos, three broken sounds, corresponding to our three, the Shvorim and the Trua, and her soul departed her body, and Avraham Avinu came and found her dead. That's the description of Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer. So it would seem from the following Midrash two things. One, that the sounding of the shofar harkens back to Sarah. That the reason we sound the shofar is because Sarah wept six different kinds of cries, and corresponding to her cries, that's why we sound the shofar. So we have some question over here whether or not this is a contradiction to the Gemara that says that the sounding of the shofar is really supposed to remind us of the offering up of Yitzchak, and in his stead the ram which got caught in a thicket, and Avram took and offered up the ram instead of Yitzchak. That's question number one. Is there a contradiction between the way the Medrash Rabbah and the Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer see it as opposed to our Gemara? Our Gemara seems to derive it from the ram of Yitzchak, which was brought in his stead, and the the Medrash and the Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer seems to draw it to the cries of Sarah. Second of all, it would appear over here that Sarah flunked the test. That whereas Avram Avinu submitted with complete faith to the test of the Akedah, that Sarah was not equal to this challenge, and that when she was advised of what Avram was doing, or what Avram had done, according to the Medrash Rabbah, it was Yitzchak himself who told them. She saw Yitzchak was alive. So you would imagine that she would be proud of the fact that Avram Avinu was able to do what he did, and that Yitzchak gladly surrendered offered to surrender his life. And instead, she sort of went into shock and died. So Sarah does not emerge from these descriptions as a particularly exalted figure. So we need to understand whether in fact that's the case. Push your thing down for a second, Doug. At the conclusion of the morning Karbonos, we have the 13 interpretive rules, how we approach interpreting certain things from the Torah. And one of them is something called klal uprat uklal. That if you find in the written Torah, you find initially kind of a general principle, and then you find details, and then you find another all-embracing kind of a principle, that we are to understand that there is a certain dynamic going on here which invites us to make an inference. We are to infer that the Torah wants us to go beyond the details that it enumerates explicitly to include other things, but that the other things should be like the details. So, for example, somebody steals something. Then he has to pay back, depending on the circumstances of the theft, he has to pay back double what he paid. What? Of what he stole. He has to pay back double what he stole. So there's an enumeration over here of if the that which he stole is discovered in his hands, in other words, he's caught with the goods, whether it's an ox or it's a donkey or it's a sheep, chayim, they're alive, Shnayim Yishalim, then you have to pay double. So the Gemara treats this as a klal or prat klal, as a klal, meaning a rule, general, prat, the specific, and again a klal. If you find in his hands what he's stolen, well, that includes everything, anything he's stolen. If you discover that somebody has something that they've stolen, then it goes on to enumerate an ox, a donkey, a sheep, and then goes on to talk about chaim, anything at all which is alive, which includes more than just those specific details. So we learn from here a number of things, that this law of paying back double applies to anything which is portable, because that's one common denominator between all the details. They're all portable. They're all things which move. That would exclude if somebody steals property. If somebody steals property, then you don't have to pay back double the amount of property. It would exclude, all of these things have a value. It would exclude a contract. A contract is a piece of paper. It has no inherent value. If somebody's stolen a contract, as much as that contract may be worth a lot of money, maybe somebody stole a check. You can't pay back double. But you don't have to pay back double.
Property,
yes.
Real estate. Real property.
You move your fence.
A tangible.
What?
Something tangible.
No, well, this is tangible. Property is tangible.
Yeah.
You take your fence and you move it into your friend's property. You steal 10 feet of his property.
Personal property is double.
What?
Personal property is double.
Oh, no. All portable things you pay back double. Right, but when we're talking about, right. But if you take land, then you don't pay back double because it's not portable. There's a law of, for example, of Maisa, that on the first and second years of the Shemitah, that you take your produce and you carry it to Jerusalem. What happens if you got too much produce to carry it to Jerusalem? So then you redeem it for its value. You take the money to Jerusalem. And in Jerusalem, you buy food. What kind of things can you buy in Jerusalem? Can you buy cars with it? Can you buy jewelry with it? So it says as follows. And you shall give the money for anything which your heart desires. Cattle, sheep, wine, old wine. Whatever your heart desires. So we have a klal or prat. Starts it by saying, whatever your heart desires. That's everything. That includes drill press, anything. Nintendo, whatever. I mean, it includes almost anything. Then it goes on to enumerate. Then he goes on to enumerate certain details. Then concludes again, whatever your heart desires. The fact that it appears in that kind of a context tells us that it's not only, you don't only have to buy meat of cattle or sheep or it's not only wine or drink, could be any kind of a food. However, it does exclude certain things. They must be things which are sustained by the produce of the earth. So that would exclude fish. You can't buy fish with it. And what else does it exclude? It excludes you can't buy salt or water, because all of these things, like wine, come from fruit. So it's got to be something that comes from something which grows. You can't, salt doesn't come from anything which grows. What?
Drill.
No, drill press also wouldn't.
But you said sheep and animals that are sustained by something?
By the ground.
Well, that's sustained by the ground. That's why fish would not be okay. In any event, what you have over here is that, I mean, the tailor could have given us the rule itself, but the tailor wanted us to do something. It wanted us to use our faculties to look at the details and to extract from the details a certain underlying common denominator, and then to apply that common denominator in all other instances. The tailor wanted us to do that rather than just giving, the tailor could have given us the rule. You can buy anything which is, you got to pay kefil, double, for anything which is portable and which has a value or whatever. Or you can buy food with your Maisa Sheni money, anything which is sustained by the ground, and what was the other thing I said? Or anything sustained by the ground, or which is a fruit of a fruit, like wine, or could be oil also, I guess. In any event, you have this concept of klal uprat uklal, that there is a general rule, and then there is a detail, and then there is a general rule. And when you find things in that context, the general affects the specific, and the specific takes on the characteristics of the generalizations. When we look at the way in which the service of the Almighty is to be understood by us, we find that there is that kind of a dynamic. We draw upon our sources and our origins. In our case, that means a number of things, that we have a soul which is derived from the Almighty Himself, that we have been taught by the Almighty and versed in His wisdom, although when we come into this world we forget what we've learned, but we've got all of the cells and all of the traces really deeply ingrained in our being from that experience. So we've been exposed to the highest of heavens, and we are given the wisdom of Torah and mitzvahs. We've been given instructions, and those instances are instances in which we are somehow to draw upon. We are the students, and we look out at life, and we look for the opportunities in which we can connect up with the underlying substratum over here. We try to find the divine course of action in all things. We wake up in the morning, we look for a divine opportunity, an opportunity in which we can draw upon that sacred force to hallow our waking up. In certain instances, to refrain from doing something which would obscure things that are holy. So we go through these tensions throughout the day, looking for that tissue which connects all of the details so that it flows back into the cloud. And as we do these things, as we assert all of the origins of all of the embracing principles of sanctity in our lives, we find ourselves carried back to the cloud. We find ourselves returning once again to the source, to be reinvested, to be uplifted, to be exposed, and to discover new forces that will allow us to affect all of the pratim of our lives in ways which we were unable to do before. So there's this dynamic. It's a revolving dynamic. The more we draw upon Kedusha, the deeper we are able to affect the world in which we live from all of the energy of that klal, the more we are able to do that, it carries us back to the klal. It carries us back to the source where we are steeped even more profoundly, and which sends us back into life to act with even greater force and greater impact. Let's take, if you will, a parable of sorts. There is a monarch who has many children. calls his children in, and he says to them, I want to send you out to some of the very far states of my empire. And before you leave, I want to show you a very specific something, because when you get there, I want you to leave somehow the mark of what I show you in the very best way that you know how. And he shows them a leaf from his personal garden. And they each come up and they scrutinize this leaf, and they look at its shape, and they look at the detail, and they study its color, and they try to commit it to memory. And then he sends them off. And he sends them off to these really far off places, and when they come there, they discover a world of black and white, where all of the flora and everything that they see is black and white. Now, the king has prepared a way for this to happen, and he has sent one of his emissaries there to be the possessor of colors. And that possessor of colors is instructed as follows. You are to charge so much for the color green, and so much for the color red, and so much for the color orange, and so on. They have, under no circumstances are you to release all of the colors at once, unless somebody, one of my children, comes and asks for a huge order of black and white. So one of the children comes, looks out at all of the flora of the land. It's all black and white. And he remembers what this leaf of the king's garden, of their father's garden, looks like. And so they go and they make an inquiry, where can we get some green paint? And they tell him, well, there is somebody who has a paint shop. He's got green paint. The guy goes and he makes an inquiry. The guy says to him, well, green paint will cost you $1,000. Well, they don't have two pennies to their name. So one of them says, well, what about, he goes back out, goes over to the nearest tavern, sits down and has a beer. And then somebody suggests to him that maybe he should have some schnapps, that maybe, well, whatever, gets caught up in a lot of things, never gets to paint diddly squat. One of the children decides that they'll look for a job and they'll earn a few pennies, and they will draw, if nothing else, they'll draw the shape of the leaf, so that people will be able at least to identify what a really beautiful leaf looks like. And maybe they'll somehow snip these ugly leaves of their part of the world, so that it at least has some shape that resembles the shape of the king's leaves. And there's one who takes this stuff very seriously, takes a job, works extremely hard, has absolutely little time to indulge all of the things that are going on in the kind of the fun things of the kingdom, gets the amount of money, goes and buys the green paint, buys parchment, and makes a magnificent replica of the king's leaf. Shape is wonderful, and the detail is remarkable, and the color is brilliant. And he hangs it up, and everybody is very fascinated with this splendorous leaf. And so they all run to work so that they can buy green paint, so that they can snip the leaves of their own gardens and paint them the same color green. The king, who has his supervisors, sees which of his children happens to be drawing the right colors, which are not, which are putting themselves out, which are not. And the one who has made this magnificent leaf is summoned back to the king's palace, and the king shows him a flower, a red rose. Says to him, I want you to try to commit this to memory. Commits this rose to memory. He goes back, and all the flowers are in black and white. And he discovers that in order for him to buy red, he's got to work. It cost him $2,000. Huh? The prince, who longs to be connected with the kingdom, with his father's palace, works very hard, gets the red color, makes a magnificent canvas in which there is this rose, which is alive. It's a beautiful rose. And he himself takes comfort in it because it reminds him of his father. And as soon as he finishes this masterwork, he's once again summoned back to the palace, where the king opens up a window onto his garden and shows him a garden full of blossoms. Once again, he is sent forth. Well, every time he comes back to the palace and is shown more and more of the king's wondrous garden, it's more and more difficult for him to leave. He wants to stay in the king's palace, and he wants to enjoy these delights instead of finding himself in this colorless wilderness. There's one thing which he has come to find whenever he looks out at an ever greater expanse of the king's magnificent garden, because then he sees meadows, and he sees hills, he sees mountains. One thing which intrigues him, which he would like to be able to bring to the world, is that rainbow that he sees in the skies above this magnificent expanse. Comes back on one occasion, and he desperately doesn't want to leave, but the king tells him he's got to go back once more. And the king says to him, I want you to go back there right now, and I want you to take every one of your canvases, and I want you to paint them black and white. All these canvases that you've done for the whole thing, I want you to paint them all black and white. So he goes back, and he recognizes that there's a lot of canvases there that he's done over all these years. And he comes in and he says to the guy from the paint shop, he says, I need a ton of black and white. And the proprietor of the colors says to him, what are you going to do with this black and white? He says, well, I have to obliterate all of the canvases. I just got to paint them all black and white. And he knows that he's going to die when he does it. He just feels that, first of all, whenever he looked at these canvases, he was reminded of the palace. He was reminded of his father. He was reminded of all the beauty that he beheld when he was there. And now he's going to divorce himself from all that beauty. And so the guy gives him a black and white paint. And he goes into this large hall, which is visited by so many people when they want to go and color their world. And he's about to splash this black paint over the canvas when the proprietor comes and says to him, cut it out. This was the key to all of the colors. not only are you not to paint the black, to obliterate this thing, but I am now to open all of the colors to you, and you can paint your rainbow. So the rainbow that towers over, that rules over the heavens of this place, will now bear all of the colors of the rainbow. When people are operating within the scope of Torah and mitzvahs in the right way, when we understand where we're coming from and where we're going, then the objective is that we go through life trying to find ways in which we can paint on these opportunities that come before us something which will carry into this colorless world, this world which is a physical and finite and moribund world, the colors of infinity, the colors of the king's garden. We try to bring into it some semblance of what it means to be connected to the royal palace. And so all of these opportunities come up, and every time we do it right, and every time we paint it with such exquisite detail because it reminds us or offers us an opportunity to establish a connection with the divine palace, that very depiction, that very work itself carries us back to the palace where the king opens up constantly greater expanses for us to scrutinize, to see, to behold, for us to be able to splash in this colorless world even greater detail, richer colors, brighter things that will open up to ourselves and to the world a connection with the king. Avraham Avinu was along with his wife, Sarah, were constantly going back and forth, drawing the king's palace in a world which was bereft of the divine, bringing sanctity into all of those precincts which were so distant from godliness, and in the process, being summoned back by the very act itself, being summoned back to the palace for an even greater exposure. Now, Avraham Avinu, when he came upon his ultimate test, was then offered the colors to the rainbow. When he went through the Akedah, he was offered to be able to behold the greatest vision of the divine. The moment in which Avraham Avinu prepared to splash all of his works, which would distance him, which would destroy everything that he had taught, at that moment Avraham Avinu was really given the keys to the king's palace. And he was able to bring all of the beauty of the king's palace now to that ugly precinct of the world. Sarah was no less prepared to sacrifice Isaac. But Sarah, when she went through this exercise, in whichever way she went through it, and she was involved in it, she was immersed in it, and she heard what Avram had done, she went through the same experience, but she didn't come back. The sacrifice was something that she was prepared to do. She was prepared and rejoiced to give up Yitzchak, she was prepared to splash paint all over the canvases. But being summoned back to the palace for the readiness and the willingness to do that opened up for her an expanse that she did not want to leave again. Avraham was prepared to return from that experience and paint the rainbow. The greatness of Avraham in the Akedah was the fact that engaged in this Akedah, it carried him to such an exalted place that he was able to return and affect a world of animalism. To be able to take a ram, which signifies the beast, the animal, the lowly, the base in life, and to offer that, to sublimate even that upon the altar of God, that force was now his. He was now able to affect even the animal. But the willingness to come back from that vision, the willingness to return, having been carried to that height, to return, to affect the world with that exposure, that Avram was prepared to do. When you recognize what he might have had, what he could have had, at this moment of greatest triumph, greatest intimacy with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, having done his will, where it meant the destruction of everything that he held near and dear, it lifted him to such a place where he should never have wanted to leave. But he came back to affect an even yet more distant place in the world, to color that rainbow which was so far away. And Sarah, when she beheld what her readiness to participate in the Akedah was, it was for her, she wasn't coming back. Sarah died with the Akedah, because for her it was a moment of such intimacy, her readiness to surrender her child in whatever circumstances, whether it's according to the first medrash, the second medrash, but her willingness to surrender Yitzchak carried her to the divine in a place where she said, I never want to leave here again. And so Sarah at that moment passed away. But Avram came back. Avram came back to this mundane world, came back to this black and white wilderness to splash the colors of the Akedah all over the world. Eventually, the story of the world is that at the end of time, that the Almighty will bring us back to the palace and will never send us away again. But for the time being, we are forced in this cycle back into the world, to go back to the source, to go back to the well, to go back to the fountain, to fetch the colors, to come back and to bring greater beauty into this world of distance, of ugliness. And so we have this paradigm of klal, uprat, uklal. The world is this cycle. We go to the palace, we draw on its beauty, and then we come into this world and we paint the world. And painting the world brings us back to the klal, brings us back to the general. And so we're constantly in this cycle of klal, uprat, klal. And that's the nature of our tekiyas. The nature of our tekiyas is that there is a single sound. It's a sound, an unbroken sound. It's a general sound. And from that general sound, from that klal, we now take the strength of that sound and we begin to break it up. We articulate it into small little parts. And that small, those small parts are a cry. Because whenever we leave the klal, whenever we leave the palate, whenever we travel at a distance from our source, it is a time of longing, a time of loneliness, a time of detachment, of separation. And so the time of our details, the time of Torah and mitzvahs, is time in which we are separated from the klal. But as we engage in these Torah and mitzvahs, we find that it carries us back again, and we become reattached. Only to be re-energized so that we can go back to the details, so that we can go back to our distance and our longing and our crying. And life is this peculiar tension and this peculiar paradox of drawing on the source, being attached to the source, and separating from the source so that we can do something about returning with greater strength, greater vision. And that cycle is the cycle of Kiyas Shofar, and that's the cycle of Torah and Mitzvahs. We sound the horn of an ayil because our ultimate destination is for us to be able to elevate even the animal. For us to be able to do what Avraham Avinu, what our patriarch did, which was to go so high that we could hallow even those things which were so low. The higher we can climb, the deeper we can paint. At the same time, the number of sounds that we create correspond to Sora, because it was Sora's sound, Sora's weeping, which really encompassed the way in which the ultimate destination of Klal Yisrael is. The ultimate destination of Klal Yisrael is to go home and stay home. And at the end of time, to be able to reach that level of accomplishment, so that the world is colored in all of the colors of the king's garden, and that the entire world is the king's garden. I think we need to stop and ask ourselves some very serious questions. Are we part of the klal uprat to klal paradigm? Or are we lost either in the klalim? We're so preoccupied with the theoretical and with the vision that we have no use at all to apply the colors that we've seen. There are those people who are distant from action. There are those people who find it too difficult to put out the effort, to buy the paints. Or there are some of us who become so involved in the details that we've forgotten that we have some colors that we're supposed to bring to this world. We're engaged in rolling around in all of the flora of this world, but we're not willing to change it at all. Do we understand that we're here for a very special reason. That the king has dispatched us to bring color, royal color, divine color to the world. That somehow that the furthest recesses of this world will be reminded of the fact that there is a divine presence. We're going to appear on Rosh Hashanah. And Rosh Hashanah is going to be a time which is going to bring us into this klal uprat paradigm. Rosh Hashanah is the first klal. It acknowledges God's kingship, His sovereignty over our lives, that we are His children. And then there are going to be some weekdays. There will be 7 weekdays which follow. There will be 7 pedestrian days in which we are somehow to take what we have seen in the king's palace and put it upon the canvas of our lives. And then there's going to be another klal. We call that Yom Kippur. And it's going to take us back to the king's palace where we're going to be removed from all of the things that we were just involved in, such things as eating and drinking and certain pleasures of that are part of the weekday world. And now we're going to remove ourselves so that we can once again immerse ourselves in the king's palace, only at a higher level than before. Because in Rosh Hashanah, we did engage in certain things that were physical, and now we're going to be totally removed so that God, as it were, the king can expose us to an even higher level, from which we would be expected to go back again from that klal into the pratim of our world. So we are, on Rosh Hashanah, we're going to enter the paradigm of klal uprat klal. We're going to start with the first, with the source. We're going to start with God's sovereignty. We're going to begin with our commitment of servitude to the colors of God's kingdom, to all of the things that Torah in mitzvahs allows us to understand. It presumes that we are ready to be educated, that when the king holds out his hand with a leaf in it, that we are looking at it and not somewhere else, and that we're looking at the color and we're looking at the shape and that we're looking at the all these little details of the leaf, and later on at the rose and its blossoms and perhaps its thorns, and later on at all the details of the meadow, and later on all of the expanse that includes the hills and then the mountains, and perhaps a view of the world in its entirety. But that requires a commitment to learning, a commitment to knowing what to look for, to understand when these opportunities come for us to be able to paint upon the canvas of our lives the colors of God's world. We have no such sense of mission on an ongoing basis. Learning is an exercise which is all too frequently something burdensome. And we fail to appreciate that each such occasion is an opportunity for us to carry with us into life something that will allow us the wherewithal make a replica, something which is reminiscent of the divine garden, so that we can once again be summoned back for a greater vision which will enable us to paint even greater expanses of our lives. The ultimate question is whether or not we can find our way into the paradigm of the klal uprat klal, to recognize that we are constantly moving through. A return to the source, to be able to affect the different parts and details of our lives. If we lose our connection to the source, and we perform our mitzvahs in a colorless way, in a lifeless way, and there's no longing, and there's no love, and there's no yearning attached to it, if it's not to recreate the divine garden, if somehow we lose our way, then we appear before the divine throne at this time of Klal, and the king can only be impressed by the fact that we've misunderstood our mission. And when we come back to the Klal, come back to the source, come back to the Mukkah, come back to the root, and we fill ourselves with this divine force, with this spiritual color, and then we come with a sensitivity and an excitement to color our world with all things that are holy, that will carry us back for bigger and better things, and our lives will be full of this capacity to never be too distant from the palace of the king, because if nothing else, the canvases surround us. Tshuva, of which Rosh Hashanah is the beginning, the first of the Aseres Yimei Tshuva, is to be understood within that context. It means being able to go back home. For us to recognize that we have let too many opportunities go by, or that there are times when instead of painting things the way they should be, we painted them otherwise. And we say to ourselves, that's not the way we want it. We want to go back home. We want to see things the way they really are, so we can then fill the world with the divine orchard. So Rosh Hashanah is the beginning of that process. It's immersing ourselves in the Klal. It's submerging ourselves in the king's palace, in his sanctity, and all of the many things that accepting his service means. It's the first act of tshuva, it's the first act of going home, but it requires, the sounding of the shofar requires that we understand that we are to do so that we can come back and we can make the aisle part of the work in which we do, that we can elevate even those furthest recesses of our lives by placing them on God's altar. And ultimately, it will carry us to being able to go back to the Klal, being able to go back and visit once again the palatial residence, and there to be reinvested with an even greater vision. I would submit that we find ourselves this Rosh Hashanah asking ourselves whether or not we are prepared to live up to that mission, to see to it that no aspect of our lives will be empty of the our effort to connect it up to the Klal, so that every prat, every specific, will carry with it a imprint of the Klal. What? No. The sounds, Francine reminds me, shofar of soul, the sounds that we use are because, I thought I saw this sentence before, is because in reality, Sarah's position is the ultimate destination of Klal Yisrael. The ultimate, what? It is the ultimate destination of Klal Yisrael.
Sora's shofar.
Sora's cry. Her cry, which were the sounds of the tekiah, the sounds of the klal, and the sounds of the prat, were such that it carried her to the klal in a way that she didn't come back. And that's really kind of where Sora really represents the ultimate design of creation. What?
At the end of time.
The end of time. That's the tekiah gedola. Well, he certainly did not want to bring Sara to that. He wanted to bring her to a situation in which she might disdain what had happened or repudiate what had happened. And instead, she embraced it with such a joy that it carried her to that to a place. And she stood up. Right.